I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. To avoid persecution by the Nazi regime in his native Germany, businessman Alex Goldschmidt and his 17-year-old son Helmut boarded a ship in Hamburg in 1939, hoping to find refuge in Cuba, and, if that did not work out, perhaps the United States. There were more than 900 other German Jewish refugees aboard the ocean liner St. Louis that spring, all hoping and praying to avoid the gathering storm of Hitler's Holocaust. 75 years later, Martin Goldschmidt tells the riveting, infuriating, and heartbreaking story of Alex and Helmut Goldschmidt, his grandfather and uncle. A voyage of betrayal, a journey of remembrance, on Midday next. And welcome to Midday's second hour. Dan Rodericks here, and thank you for joining us. In this hour of the show, a story of a man's pursuit of his family's story from Germany in the 1930s in the time of the Nazis and the start of the persecution of Jewish citizens to desperate days aboard an ocean liner that should have been a vessel to freedom for hundreds of German Jews, to refugee camps in France, to the nightmare of the Holocaust. Martin Goldschmidt has written a riveting, infuriating, and heartbreaking story about his grandfather, Alex Goldschmidt, and his uncle, Helmut, as they attempted to flee Nazi Germany and start a new life on this side of the Atlantic. They were passengers aboard the MS St. Louis, a ship of the Hamburg-America line bound for Havana. But the St. Louis was turned away by Cuban authorities. It was turned away by President Roosevelt and the U.S. government, too. It was turned away by Canada. The fate of the St. Louis, and more importantly, that of Alex and Helmut Goldschmidt, is what Martin Goldschmidt set out to learn nearly 70 years after the spring day when the ship sailed from Hamburg. After an odyssey through Europe to retrace the steps of his grandfather and uncle, Martin Goldschmidt wrote a book about events that occurred years before he was born. It is a rich and well-researched chronicle that not only filled in the missing pieces of his family's story, but provided the author with a way to come to grips with the great burden the Holocaust had left on him. Martin Goldschmidt, who lives here in Maryland, is known to many NPR listeners for his years as host of Performance Today. He is now the programmer and host of Symphony Hall on Sirius XM. Martin Goldschmidt is a graduate of the Johns Hopkins University, and among other accomplishments, sang with the Baltimore Opera Chorus. His previous book, The Inextinguishable Symphony, told the story of his parents and the all-Jewish Nazi-era arts ensemble in which they performed. The new book is called Alex's Wake, A Voyage of Betrayal and a Journey of Remembrance. Martin Goldschmidt, welcome to Midday. It's nice to have you with us.
It's great to be here with you, Dan. Thank you.
And congratulations on this book.
Thank you.
When did you first know that your grandfather and uncle, Alex Goldschmidt and his son, Helmut, had been aboard the St. Louis?
It was among the things I learned, Dan, when I researched and wrote the first book, The Inextinguishable Symphony. My father, when I began work on the book, reached down literally onto the bottom drawer of his desk and pulled out a stack of maybe 3-4 inches tall of letters that he had received from his father and his brother from those camps in France, and he said simply, "You may want to look at these." And it was from those letters and other very few bits of information my father told me that I learned that they had been aboard the St. Louis.
So growing up, you were born in St. Louis, you grew up in Cleveland, you landed here in Maryland at some point, but growing up, your father, your mother, what would they say about these people in your family who had disappeared, who you never knew?
Virtually nothing. It's an interesting fact, apparently, Dan, that many people of my parents' generation said nothing about what had happened to them and to their parents. It was, I guess, so painful that they just didn't want to deal with it. They just packed them away into a metaphorical lower drawer of their desks. And I remember once when my elder brother, he was 3 years older than me, once said, in effect, "Well, how come we can't go over the river and through the woods to grandmother's house at Thanksgiving? Where are our grandparents?" And my father said, they died in the war. And they never, my parents never expressly said, don't talk about this, but we sort of inherited the idea that, you know, this was just not something that we would talk about any more than we would talk about bauxite mining in Peru. These were just subjects that didn't exist for us.
Those letters that you referred to that your father handed to you, those are some amazing documents. These are letters written by Alex and also by his son Helmut from the various camps where they lived in 1940, 41, 42. They're amazing. We'll talk about those letters during this hour of the show. But, I mean, what eye-opener that must have been for you. It must have been a shock for you to read these.
It was, because, again, they were murdered 10 years before I was born. I never met them. I never knew them. I never had any physical remains or reminders of them. And suddenly to hold in my hand these onion skin papers with almost indecipherable German script on it was both very, very exciting, because it was a tangible reminder that they had actually been on this earth at one point, and terribly sad because, of course, they were gone, and gone in such a terrible way.
You must have had an inkling that they had died in the Holocaust.
Yes. Eventually, later in his life, actually after my mother died, my father got in touch with the International Red Cross to try to find out more details about what had happened to his family. And it was through them that we found out that Alex had been gassed at Auschwitz. But it wasn't really until about 10 years after that that, thanks to some wonderful work by archivists down at the U.S. Memorial Holocaust Museum in Washington, that I learned what had happened to Helmut. Because his actual name was Klaus Helmut Goldschmidt, and I always knew him just as Helmut. And that, when you put that into the database, it didn't show up. But then some enterprising archivist in Washington put in Klaus Helmut Goldschmidt, and we found out that he, too, was on Convoy 19 from Drancy to Auschwitz on August 14th, 1942. It's amazing how certain dates stick with you.
Another date would be May 1939, a specific day. Probably you have it in your...
May 13th.
May 13th, 1939. Now, that is the day that the MS St. Louis, also known as the SS St. Louis, sailed from Hamburg, right?
Correct. It was a fascinating story, just that part of the story, Dan, because here were over 900 Jewish refugees essentially being booted out of Germany, but booted out on a luxury ocean liner. And it was because of a confluence of events, the desire of the Nazis at this point. This was an interim solution to what would eventually result in the final solution of what they called the Jewish problem. This interim solution was, let's get as many Jews out of the country as we can. The Hamburg-America line at that moment, a very famous shipping line, was undergoing some financial difficulties. The head of the line was an avowed Nazi, and they all worked together to realize, well, we can get Jews out of the country. We'll ask them to pay full freight, so the St. Louis will make a nice bunch of money on this journey, and the Jews will, you know, get out of the country. So it was what must have been an amazing spectacle for these refugees. Virtually all of them probably had been arrested on Kristallnacht, as my grandfather had been, November 9th, 1938. And they'd all been horribly mistreated for the last 6 years. And here they are being booted out of the country, and they walk up the gangplank onto the St. Louis, and there's leaded crystal on these dining tables with fine white tablecloths on them. There is a gymnasium. There is a swimming pool. There's an orchestra. There are dances. You know, Glenn Miller on the journey over to Havana. They must have thought, well, if we were being kicked out of the country, this is not really such a bad way to go.
It must have been surreal.
Exactly.
In addition to what you listed in terms of the amenities aboard this ocean liner, the St. Louis, there was this captain, a captain who was deferential to his Jewish passengers.
Gustav Schroeder, who from the very beginning was aware of what was going on, but he said, I'm the captain of this ship. I'm going to see to it that these people who have paid full fare will be given a very pleasant journey. There were some Nazi underlings among the crew that he ordered not to, you know, do anything to make the passengers uncomfortable. And then on the return journey to Europe, he did everything he could to ensure that the ship would not sail back to Germany, because he knew what would happen to the refugees if that would be the case.
We're going to tell this story of the St. Louis here with Martin Goldsmith, his book Alex's Wake. But growing up, I'm curious, what did you know about the St. Louis? Did you know anything about it? Because, you know, if you say to Americans who have paid attention to the history of the Holocaust and World War II, you say, oh, that was the ship full of Jewish refugees that FDR wouldn't allow to dock in the United States. And they'll say, oh, yes, I know that story. Is that a true story? I've different reactions from different people. But what did you know about the St. Louis growing up?
Well, growing up, I knew nothing about it, even though, coincidentally, I was born in St. Louis, Missouri. There was nothing about it. I think, like many people, I first heard about it from a film called Voyage of the Damned, which, let's see, Malcolm McDowell was in that, Faye Dunaway was in that. It was based on a book by that same title.
This is from the 1970s.
Early 70s, 71, 72. And, of course, this was all as the Holocaust was becoming more and more a part of American conversation, which it hadn't been. I mean, as I understand it, the word Holocaust to designate what happened to the Jews of Europe during the Second World War didn't really come into usage until about 10 years after the war, 1955, and it wasn't until after the Eichmann trial of 1960 and 61 that Americans really began to pay attention closely to what had happened during the Holocaust. So,
but the St. Louis, which was this ocean liner that tried to come to port in Havana first, and was turned away, and then was turned away by U.S. authorities, and then turned away by Canadian authorities. There was a lot of press about this boat, a ship full of refugees at the time, right?
Absolutely. There were front page articles, front page above the fold articles in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. There were demonstrations in the streets of D.C. and Baltimore and New York and Atlantic City. There were editorial cartoons. Edward G. Robinson and a number of other Hollywood stars sent a telegram to FDR in the White House saying, in the name of humanity, please allow this ship to dock in the United States. So this, by no means was this a ship sailing under cover of darkness.
There were demonstrations in favor of taking the St. Louis in,
yes.
The passengers.
Yes.
There were demonstrations in Havana, anti-Semitic demonstrations also.
Exactly. Well, yes, the reason that the St. Louis passengers were not able to get off in Havana is a story unto itself. There was a newspaper magnate who owned virtually all the newspapers in Havana, who was an avowed anti-Semite, an admirer of Hitler and Franco, and he would regularly whip up anti-Semitic fears with editorials. But there was also a power play between this fellow named Benitez, who was in a functionary in the government, and President Beru of Cuba. And Mr. Benitez had issued these landing certificates that people had to buy if they wanted to get off in Havana. But once the ship arrived in Havana Harbor, President Beru essentially said, I'm the one who's going to decide who gets off in our city, and if you don't have one of my landing certificates, you don't get to disembark. So of the 938 people who left Hamburg, only about a couple dozen were allowed to get off the ship in Havana, and there were 907 who then were on board the ship when it weighed anchor and sailed north to the coast of the United States.
And within sight of the lights of Miami, you
exactly
write in your book, and again turned away by the United States.
Yes, ostensibly because of the Immigration Act of 1924, which held that there were certain quotas that could only be filled for certain countries. And the rationale went that if we allow these 900 refugees from Austria and Germany to land, we'll have to push an equal number farther back down the line of people who had gone through the proper procedures and filled out all the right forms and everything. And I'm sure there was also the fact that FDR was ginning up to launch what would be his unprecedented third term as president, and he didn't want immigration issues to be a part of all of this. There were other factors involved. There was a certain strain of anti-Semitism in this country at the time. So there were many, many factors that led to the ship not being allowed to dock in Miami or Baltimore or New York or any American port.
Martin Goldsmith is our guest in this hour of midday. 75 years later, he tells the story of Alex and Helmut Goldschmidt, his grandfather and uncle, a voyage of betrayal, a journey of remembrance here on midday. We'll take a short break and come back and tell more of the story from Alex's Wake, Martin Goldsmith's book, A Short Break. Martin Goldsmith's father and mother, musicians both, had managed to flee Nazi Germany as war loomed, but other members of Martin Goldsmith's Jewish family were not as fortunate. His paternal grandfather was a successful businessman named Alex Goldschmidt. He and his 17-year-old son, Helmut, boarded a ship in Hamburg in May 1939, hoping to find refuge in Cuba. There were more than 900 other German-Jewish refugees aboard the ocean liner St. Louis that spring, all hoping and praying to flee the Third Reich and start a new life in a new country that welcomed them. But they found all ports unwelcoming, and the ship had to be returned to Europe. Martin Goldsmith is our guest. His book is Alex's Wake, the title a reference to his grandfather, Alex Goldschmidt, A Voyage of Betrayal and a Journey of Remembrance. The Voyage of Betrayal, referencing, of course, the St. Louis voyage. A Journey of Remembrance is the trip that you took to retrace the steps of this grandfather you never knew, an uncle you never knew. You started that you left Maryland in 2011 and started this trek. My question is, did you expect to write a book when you set out to retrace the steps of Alex and Helmut?
I hoped to. I write in the opening chapter of the book, setting forth, my father died at age 95 in 2009. He had struggled the last couple of years of his life with Alzheimer's, and he lived in an Alzheimer's facility down in Rockville, Maryland, near where my wife and I live. And, you know, we would visit with him regularly, and often he would talk about how he wanted to go back to Oldenburg, his hometown, and play in the Schlossgarten, which was right down the street from the beautiful house he grew up in. And we would talk fancifully about all of that. I knew, of course, that would never happen. So he died in 2009, and then less than a year later, exactly 11 months later, in fact, my brother suddenly died of a heart attack, completely out of the blue. And in trying to come to terms with that loss, I decided that I would want to write another book about my family. And I realized I'd always been galvanized by the story of Alex and Helmut, not only about the St. Louis voyage part of their story, but then those next 3 years when they were shuttled from one camp in France to another before being sent to Auschwitz. So it came to me one late winter, early spring night, a little over 3 years ago, that I wanted to retrace their steps. So I began getting in touch with certain people, doing more research at the Holocaust Museum in D.C. to find out exactly where they had been during those 3 years, and realized it would probably take 6 weeks. It turned out we drove more than 5,700 miles, almost twice across this country, east to west and back again. But yes, I thought that I hoped at any rate I would glean enough during those 6 weeks to write a book.
Martin Goldsmith, why don't you take us to Oldenburg in this beautiful house that you just referred to, and in the process tell us about your grandfather, Alex Goldschmidt, who was, I know, 60 years old by the time you stepped into this story, by the time the St. Louis left Hamburg. Mm-hmm. So please tell us about him and that house in that town.
Alex Goldschmidt was born on January the 1st, 1879. He was one of eight children. He had been a member of a family of horse breeders. His father, my great-grandfather, and his grandfather, my great-great-grandfather, they'd all been horse breeders and horse traders in this little village called Sachsenhagen in Lower Saxony, about maybe 30, 35 miles southwest of Hanover. But he didn't want to be part of the horse trade, so he founded a woman's clothing store in Oldenburg called the Haus der Mode, the House of Fashion. And every fashionable lady bought dresses and hats and shoes and accessories there. He then went off to fight in the Great War. He was quite fortunate because he fought all 4 years of World War I, was never seriously wounded, came back in 1919. The store did extremely well, and they bought this extraordinarily beautiful house. I mentioned to you during the break, if you can imagine, the most beautiful house up in Roland Park.
Right.
With trees around it and just wonderfully outfitted, probably worth, I don't know, $5, $6, $7, $8 million today. He lived in it for a few very lovely years during the 1920s. And then in 1932, Oldenburg, the state of Oldenburg in northwest Germany, became the first state to actually elect a Nazi leadership. And within weeks of their coming to power, there came a knock on the door of this house at number 34 Gartenstrasse, and a couple of Nazi officials told my grandfather Alex it was not right for a Jew to own such a marvelous house that used to own, that used to belong to one of the people who were in the employ of the Duke of Oldenburg back in imperial days. So my grandfather was forced to sell this house for a price of 26,000 marks, which works out to about $10,400. I mean, a criminally low price for what the house was worth and what it's worth now. So
here's an established businessman mm-hmm. who's successful.
Very
successful. He's being prosperous enough to own this house, mm-hmm. forced to sell it for 26,000 marks in 1932. Mm-hmm. And where do he and his family members go after that? Do they buy another house? Or
they start renting a series of apartments, each one smaller than the last. In April 1933, a few months after Hitler became chancellor, the Nazis instituted this boycott of Jewish-owned businesses. And so the Haus der Mode, the House of Fashion, began to go downhill. Things became increasingly perilous for the Jews of Germany over the next few years. Jews' driver's licenses were revoked. They had to be off the streets by 8 p.m. during the winter, 9 p.m. during the summer. They could only shop in food stores after 4 p.m. after all the fresh produce had already been taken. All manner of things were passed against them, so life became increasingly terrible for them.
Do you have any insight as to why Alex Goldschmidt and his family stayed during that period, and do you know if any other Goldschmidts left Germany during that time?
Well, of course, that's been a question that has been raised so many times. And why didn't more people leave sooner? And there are, I guess, as many reasons as there are people. My grandfather, again, had been awarded the Iron Cross First Class for his service to his country during the First World War. And he used to say, apparently, "I fought for the Kaiser. Hitler can't touch me." There are also people who believed in a German saying that translated means, "No meal is eaten as hot as it is cooked." The point being that Hitler's rabble-rousing was just that. He didn't really mean it. He was just doing this to, you know, put one over on the rubes, as one of your great predecessors, H.L. Mencken, writing for the Baltimore Sun, you know, would say, you know, there's a great rubocracy out
right,
there.
Right.
And I think a lot of sophisticated German Jews said, he doesn't really mean it. And what's the worst? You know, what's he going to do, kill us all? You know, so...
What did you know about the house in Oldenburg before this project started?
Well, I had been to Oldenburg before when I did research for the first book.
Okay.
And so I had seen it from the outside, but I hadn't been afforded a tour of the whole house until the journey at the beginning of my 6-week trip.
I wish you would describe your feelings upon meeting the present owners of that house.
The people who own the house now, an architect by the name of Karsten Meyerbohlen and his wife Monika Meyerbohlen, they bought the house a dozen years ago now. They had no idea of its history. When they learned, because our hosts in Oldenburg had put out a little article in the local newspaper saying, you know, this descendant of the Goldschmidt family is coming to town to look for clues about his family. And they used to live at 34 Gartenstrasse, and these people who currently own the house were sort of shocked, got in touch with our hosts, invited us over, and gave us a tour of this glorious house from the wine cellar in the basement up to the palatial bedrooms up top. And it was, as you might imagine, Dan, just a very emotional journey to walk through this beautiful, beautiful house that used to belong to my family.
Well, I use the word infuriating because just to read your book, your account of some of the things that happened to your grandfather and uncle, and also your expressions of feelings as you're going through this, not on a vacation, this is very genuine to me, it comes across in the book, that you didn't set out on a European vacation. You call this a journey of remembrance and took it very seriously and tried to avoid this an aura of vacation.
Well,
I
spend some time in the book, maybe too much time, I don't know, discussing the fact that my father, even though he was a poor immigrant when he arrived and didn't have a lot of resources at his command, probably did not do everything he could have to try to get his father and his brother out of those wretched camps in France over to this country. So he was consumed with guilt his whole life, and I think he passed on some of that guilt to my brother and to me, not intentionally, but it was in the air that we breathed in our house. And I was, when I set out on this trip, I could not separate the fact that while I would be following in my grandfather's and uncle's footsteps, they would make their journey at the point of a gun in a cattle car, whereas my wife and I would be driving down in an air-conditioned car, the beautiful highways and byways of France, staying in nice hotels, not palatial mansions or anything, but nice hotels, and eating French food. And I would often feel horribly guilty that I would draw up to the gates of one of these concentration camps, having just spent the night in a nice hotel. And whereas when Alex and Helmut were sleeping here, they slept on hard benches or in tufts of straw. So it was. There were times when the contrast was a little hard to stomach for me.
And your feelings in Germany at Oldenburg at 34 Gartenstrasse, when you were there and met the new owners, as nice as they could be, you had very strong mixed feelings about that.
Well, that's when they first proposed the idea of putting up a memorial plaque on the side of the house, saying, in effect, this house used to be owned by the Jewish businessman Alex Goldschmidt. He and his wife and his son and his daughter were murdered during the Holocaust. And they offered to do that, and I said, that's a very nice gesture, thank you. And that night, I went back to our host's house and couldn't sleep, and had one of those thoughts that, well, what I should have said to them was, yeah, that's a nice way to memorialize what happened. Or we could do something else. I could give you 26,000 marks, and you could give me back my house.
That was stolen from your grandfather.
Right,
In a forced sale in 1932.
Mm-hmm. Right. But I realized that was totally irrational, but, you know,
still,
late-night thoughts.
But you expressed the feeling in the book, and it comes across so beautifully, and in a heartbreaking way. Alex's Wake is the name of Martin Goldsmith's book, A Voyage of Betrayal and a Journey of Remembrance. Before we go to the next break, back to the chronology a bit, because you've mentioned France a few times
right here.
And I want to make sure our listeners follow the story that the St. Louis, unable to find a port to take these 900-plus refugees, including your grandfather and uncle, ends up back in Europe. And some of the folks on board go to England, some go to the Netherlands, some to Belgium, and some to France. And that's where your grandfather and uncle end up. They stay together. They're in France, and they end up in a series of refugee camps, internment camps at different places. One of them quite odd, a former resort where wealthy French were able to take the waters, so
exactly,
to speak, the hot springs.
Mm-hmm.
How did you find all these places?
Well,
where was the record of that?
I thank the archivists down at the Holocaust Museum. I also thank, the Jews have a word for something that is meant to be. They say something is beschert.
Beschert.
And I happened to find out that at the Holocaust Museum, I learned that one of the places they had stayed was a town called Montauban, which is a little north of Toulouse in the south of France. I learned, thanks to Wikipedia, world's greatest source, that Montauban is a sister city of the town of Pawhuska, Oklahoma. I called up City Hall at Pawhuska said, can you put me in touch with the man who does the Sister City program? Yes, it's Jack Shoemate. Here's his number. Jack, I said, I'm Martin Goldsmith trying to find somebody in Montauban. Oh, you need to write to Jean-Claude Drouillet. Here's his email address. I wrote to Jean-Claude Drouillet. He goes down to his local police department, finds out cards that document the fact that Alex and Helmut were interned in a former cookie factory for a month in 1940. But before that, they were in this little town called Martigny-les-Bains, which turns out to be, as you say, this former resort town where people would go to heal, to enjoy the healing waters. And for 2 months after Alex and Helmut got off the boat in France, they spent an idyllic time in Martigny-les-Bains, something that was referred to as an agricultural retraining center. And during July and August of 1939, fresh off the St. Louis journey, my grandfather learned to be a chicken farmer, and my uncle helped in the raising of sheep and did other jobs.
The idea there was that the Jewish refugees were going to need to be retrained,
exactly,
and also concerned that they not ply their professional trades, right? That they not show up and become bankers
and
lawyers, because
exactly,
that would foster more resentment among the French.
Exactly.
Right? That's amazing that you found that that one single document led to that much.
Mm-hmm.
And you must have been, that must have been a wow moment for you in your journey.
It was. And it was always, Dan, equal parts thrilling and saddening, because I would come upon these documents having to do with, again, these people I never knew in my life, and to be able to see pictures of them and discover letters that Alex had written from the camp in Agde, for instance, down by the Mediterranean. It was thrilling one moment and then heartbreaking the next, because I realized this is all I have left of them.
We'll hear more of the story in just a moment. You're listening to Midday on WYPR. Dan Roderick's here. Our guest, Martin Goldsmith, telling the story of his grandfather, Alex Goldschmidt, and his 17-year-old son, Helmut, Martin Goldsmith's uncle, and their attempt to flee Nazi Germany and where they ended up. A voyage of betrayal and a journey of remembrance. Alex's Wake is the name of the book. The publisher is DeCapo. More with Martin Goldsmith when we get back. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Roderick's here. Our guest, Martin Goldsmith, known to many NPR listeners for many years as the host of a classical music programming and now on Sirius XM. But he spent a good part of the last several years retracing the steps of his grandfather and his uncle. Alex's Wake is the result of that, his book, A Voyage of Betrayal and a Journey of Remembrance. The Voyage of Betrayal, of course, that's the part of the story that took place aboard the MS or SS St. Louis as Alex Goldschmidt and his son Helmut tried with more than 900 other German Jews to leave Germany and find a new place to live, either in Cuba, that didn't work out, the United States, that didn't work out. The ship was turned away here and it was turned away in Canada. Alex Goldschmidt and his son ended up in France in a series of camps. Over how long a period of time, Martin? This would have been almost 3 years, I think?
It's a bit more than 3 years. They landed in Boulogne-sur-Mer, France, on June 20th, 1939. They eventually were shipped to Auschwitz on August 14th, 1942. So, yes, they spent 3 years going from one French address to another.
This is where I want to talk about your grandfather's letters to your father. Now, your father and mother had managed to get to the United States in 1941. And they were both musicians and actually had found some work as musicians here.
In fact, my father spent one season in the Baltimore Symphony.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, these letters were coming from France, different places in France, from an increasingly bitter Alex Goldschmidt. And I was, I'm just amazed at some of the prose and his implorations in these letters, begging your father, his son, to do something. How did you feel the first time you read those? Do you remember how you felt the first time?
Well, it was just again, it's astounding to have these words, which, you know, I had to get them translated. But to have these words, which I knew had flowed from the pen of my grandfather, who was in these terrible circumstances. And when I made what I call this journey of remembrance, and having those words in my head and seeing where they were held and some of the really awful conditions. They were in this camp called Rivas Salt for a time, which is near the Pyrenees Mountains, this vast open plain. And an international Red Cross representative managed to get in, and he wrote a report in which he said no self-respecting zookeeper would subject his animals to the conditions under which these human refugees are living. My grandfather wrote that when he went into the camp was weighing about 125 pounds, and within a few months he weighed about 102 pounds, and his son was weighing 94 pounds. Terrible food. The barracks they lived in, hot in the summer, cold in the winter, nothing to do. And then they went on to the Camp Les Milles in Provence, which again, Dan, it really must be said, this was not a camp that was set up by the Nazis, who said, all right, French, run this for us. Les Milles was built expressly by the Vichy government to house what they called the undesirables, meaning the Jews. In France that they rounded up, and Jews who came from elsewhere.
Is Les Milles the brick factory?
Yes, the former brick factory. And it was from there that they were transported in August of 1942 from Les Milles to Drancy, the transit camp just north of Paris, and from there to Auschwitz. And the Jews were packed into this cattle car. And it was August 11th of 1942, a very, very hot and humid night. About 100 people were shoved into this cattle car. The doors were sealed shut, and the car sat there the rest of the night. And it didn't take off until the morning. So the cattle car is still there as part of a memorial, because Les Milles is now open as a Holocaust Memorial Museum. And a docent took my wife and me through the brick factory, which served as the prison, essentially, for these refugees, and then took us a quarter of a mile down to where the railway siding was and is. And we were in this cattle car, and it was a very lovely temperate day, sort of like it is today here in Baltimore. Couldn't have been more than 70 degrees, but it was already really warm inside that cattle car, and there were only three of us, and I imagined 100 people on a hot August night. And I couldn't get out of that cattle car fast enough, and this is a long-winded way of answering your question, but I thought of the letters that my grandfather had written to my father, and I was instantly furious with my father for not having done more to save them. And then, you know, a second later, I was just overcome with a great deal of pity for my father, because, after all, he really couldn't have done anything, and I realized that he'd had this, you know, this guilt that he had to deal with for the rest of his life. So it was those feelings which constantly did battle within me, Dan. I mean,
yes,
you know, fury and pity at the same time.
The letter your father saved goes back to the beginning of our conversation, when I asked you where you found these letters. Part of me is amazed that they existed, that they survived, that your father didn't destroy them. The last letter that he wrote, that Grandfather Alex wrote to his son: I have already described our situation for you several times. This will be the last time. If you do not move heaven and earth to help us, that's up to you, but it will be on your conscience. Are you surprised that your father saved these letters?
Well, I am and I'm not. I mean, yes, I could imagine, on the one hand, someone trying to destroy the evidence. On the other, maybe it was a way for him to serve some penance of some kind, you know, to leave this. You know, there are apparently some pilgrims who walk around with a stone in their shoe deliberately to remind them of the harshness of life. And maybe it was something that that he did deliberately.
What would you say about your father, his personality through life? I mean, it's a broad question, I guess. He lived a long time, but was he a quiet man? Was he sullen? Was he...
Well, it's interesting. Dan, when I did research for the first book and I learned more about him as a young man, he apparently was quite lighthearted as someone in his 20s, given the fact that he was growing up as a Jew in Nazi Germany. But something obviously happened after 1945, not 1946. Those grisly newsreels began to be shown about what had happened during the Holocaust. And he, I think, became quieter and more withdrawn as time went on.
I want to go back to Germany with you, back to Oldenburg, because there comes a time when the owners of the house where your grandfather lived, the house that he was forced to sell, that was stolen from him, really, they want to put up a plaque.
Mm-hmm.
The husband whose name
Carsten Meyerbolen.
Meyerbolen, the architect, right?
Yes.
Ever since meeting you, he's in sort of a funk, you say, because of knowing the history of the house now,
right,
and having met you. But they want to do something. And it's a very interesting section of your book where you describe modern Germans trying to come to grips with what the crimes of the past and how to memorialize things.
Mm-hmm.
So finally, you decide that this is okay, and they decide they want to put a plaque up on the house there. Could you talk about how this came about?
Yes. As you say, it's interesting. As I returned from my six-week journey that I took with my wife, following in the footsteps of Alex and Helmut, it ended, of course, in Auschwitz, where they were murdered in 1942. And I came back to the States determined to write the book, but beset with a certain depression upon coming back home. And then I found out that Carsten Meyerbolen, the owner of my grandfather's house, was also very depressed by having learned about the history of this house. But they decided they did want to go ahead with a plaque. He designed it himself. He chose the German words. But then I found a couplet from a poem by Emily Dickinson that I asked them to include at the bottom of the plaque, which they did. Those words are, "Remembrance has a rear and front, 'tis something like a house," which I thought was just perfect. So yes, we went back there in September of 2012, where there was a little ceremony at 34 Gartenstrasse to unveil the plaque.
I'm going to read what you had to say on that day in a moment here. I'm struck by this sentence in the last chapter of your book, Coming Home. I find it remarkable, and not for the first time, that Germany continues to have this lively debate over the best way to remember its criminal past, when too often it seems my country continues to give only lip service to the issues of slavery and the slaughter of our native population. So you found numerous stories and encountered numerous people who are still struggling with this there.
Very much so, and that's another remarkable thing about the journey, Dan. I met so many people along the way for whom the events of 70, 75 years ago are current events. I mean, Jean-Claude Ruyer, the man I mentioned in Montauban, he's the son and nephew of resistance fighters. His uncle died in Buchenwald, and the reason he said he wanted to help me was that he said, I view this as a continuation of my family's duty. And I met a woman in Drancy who was born in Oldenburg, whose father was a Nazi, who may have known Grandfather Alex. And yes, every time I go back to Germany, it seems there's another TV special or a magazine piece or a Holocaust memorial being unveiled. They are doing their best, it seems, to try to come to terms with their past.
When the plaque was dedicated at the house at 34 Gartenstrasse, you spoke, and it sounds like the house was packed full of people, and everyone wanted this to happen. They were eager to hear what you had to say. I would just read a little bit of what you said that night. Is that okay, Mark?
Of course.
You mentioned Alex, of course. His wife, Toni, was her name, and their four children that they raised in the house. We are here because in 1932, officials from the newly elected Nazi Party forced my grandfather to sell this house to one of them for a criminally low price. For the next 6 years, Alex and Tony moved several times, each time to smaller and cheaper lodgings. We are here because on the night of November 9th, 1938, my grandfather was arrested during the violence of Kristallnacht, and because the next morning he was marched through town along with 42 of his fellow Jews to the Oldenburg prison, and because the next day he was sent to the Sachsenhausen concentration camp, where he remained for nearly a month. We are here tonight because my grandfather Alex and my uncle Helmut attempted to flee Nazi Germany on board the refugee ship St. Louis, which sailed away from Hamburg May 13, 1939, bound for Cuba. We are here because the St. Louis was not allowed to land in Cuba, nor in the United States, nor in Canada. We are here because the St. Louis sailed back to Europe, because my grandfather and uncle were allowed to disembark in France, and because they then spent the next 3 years in refugee centers and internment camps. At this point, you say, I am forced to stop and dry my eyes and take a deep breath, which does little to prevent my voice from cracking. So you had a tough time with this that night. And everyone listened. I bet it was silent in that house as you spoke.
It was.
And what was it like after you finished this talk?
Well, I had to tell the story of these two Buddhist monks who were traveling back to their monastery, and it had been raining heavily, and they came to a river that was overflowing its banks, and there was a woman who asked to be taken to the other side of the river, and so the elder monk stooped and asked his companion to do the same, and the woman got up on their shoulders and went across. They went across the river and let her down, and they continued walking. And after several hours, the younger monk says, Master, we have taken certain vows, and our order is not allowed to touch women, and yet you specifically countermanded those orders, and we did what we did. Why did you do that, Master? And the older monk says, I set that woman down on the bank hours ago. Why are you still carrying her? And I said to the assembled in my grandfather's house, it is time for me to set down this burden of guilt and shame that I've carried for so long.
It's a beautiful story. Thank you very much. A beautiful ending. It's a sad and tragic story, I should say. But, I mean, that story about the Buddhist monks and the relief of burden.
And we then had this marvelous gathering at our host's house, which struck me as being a celebration of Alex and Helmut. And so I, with apologies to the Irish, I decided it was Awake.
Alex is
Awake. Yeah.
Martin Goldsmith has been our guest in this hour of midday. His book, Alex is Awake, A Voyage of Betrayal and a Journey of Remembrance. It's published by DeCapo Press. Well, I thank you for this book. I was really drawn into this story and troubled by it. Relieved toward the end. It's a catharsis, I guess. It sounds like a cliche, but this I'm holding here in my hand a catharsis, am I not?
For me, certainly, yes. Yeah. Yes, indeed, Dan. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Martin. Thank you, Martin. Goldsmith is the host and classical music programmer for Symphony Hall on Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Previously, he hosted NPR's Performance Today. He lives here in Maryland. His previous book is The Inextinguishable Symphony. This book, again, Alex's Wake, A Voyage of Betrayal and a Journey of Remembrance.